From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Rodney Crowell is my guest. Rodney Crowell was inducted into the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame a few years ago, and he has written songs for about 7 million artists. In addition to being a legend in country music with hits and Grammy Awards, Rodney Crowell is also the author of an extraordinary memoir entitled China Berry Sidewalks. Rodney Crowell, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on.
When you sequence a record album, you're kind of careful to place the rockers and the ballads in a certain order to create the mood you want. Did you do the same thing with your memoir? Did you say, oh, I'm going to start off with a rock and roll, ain't living long like this, and then segue into a Blame It on the Moon kind of ballad sequence, or what?
Well, that's pretty close. I mean, I started with a bang in China Berry Sidewalks, which is, I started with a scene that happened in on New Year's Eve 1955 that was nearly a disaster. And, you know, and because it seems like, you know, let's get this thing started off with, to get it off to a blazing start. And from there on, it settles down into a narrative that covers a lot of ground.
But you never do the, you know, I was born on this date and then this happened. It's not exactly chronological.
No, it's not. I didn't think that it sequenced well chronologically, because some of the stories needed to go ahead of the others in order to for others to make sense, oddly enough. So you know, I later on go back farther than 1955.
Yeah, you go all the way back to before you were born.
Well, that's true. A long way, a good while before I was born.
Well, you know, you obviously have a lot of love for your parents, and we see that in China Berry Sidewalks, but do you think they damaged you?
No, they didn't damage me.
No?
No, other than a few stitches in my scalp. That's not too much damage, and I didn't damage anyone, so I got off lucky there. No, actually, I would say my parents didn't damage me. They made me strong, and they made me, and they instilled in me a sense of humor and compassion. Now, understandably, if reading my book when you first get into it, I've spoken to people who think, God, how could you love these people? And I, to which I say, how could I not? Because they're so vivid and so, they were so full of life, you know. Give those kids an education and a more, you know, a better, you know, starting position in life's race, they would have been pretty extraordinary people. They were smart.
Well, you did. Yeah, I was thinking about my own grandfather, who was a musician, played the piano, and studied at Juilliard, but then the Depression came. He was born in 1909. When the Depression came, he had to give up his musical career and make a living and go into managing a department store. And the Depression had a similar effect on your father, although he was born many years later, but he had to quit school, and his ambitions were affected by that.
Yeah, they were. And a lot of sharecrop farm children had to quit school in order to work. The labor force on sharecrop farms, they needed every available hand, male and female. And both my mother and father were sons and daughters of sharecrop farmers. And they were needed to get, you know, to work that farm. And in my mother's case, her father wasn't much help. So it was up to her mother and the kids to get the crop in the ground and harvest. So I say this, and I kind of intimate it in the book, that, you know, given an education and a better chance for those two, they would have been a force to be reckoned with.
Well, I guess the reason I ask about the damage done is because there are lots of things in your house that I guess today people would say, well, that you can't raise kids in an environment that has guns and drinking and hitting and
loaded guns. And well, you've got to understand the culture. It was a, you know, a Scots-Irish biblical culture where You know, my mother adhered to the notion, the old spare the rod, spoil the child. She thought that she was doing God's work when she beat me with a switch, you know, with a limb of a tree, and a thin limb, mind you. But, you know, she thought that was her parental duty to do that. Otherwise, she didn't think she would be raising me properly. Now, you know, flash forward to when I'm a parent, it's like, you know, you'd call child services on me.
Did you make your children go and find a switch that you could hit them with?
No. Heavens no. Heavens no. But I'm not angry about it, and I understand why she did it. She thought she was doing the right thing. And my beloved sweetheart of a grandmother thought she was too. And it was another time and another place. I'm hoping young people who read my book will be enchanted, actually, by how crazy, you know, some of the customs were, you know, coming, you know, from the early part of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people had got some bad directions early on in life.
Well, when you became a parent and a husband, did you find yourself battling, you know, playing the tapes that your parents had imprinted on you and said, well, I don't want to do it that way?
Absolutely. I found myself battling. You know, it is, you know, scientific now that, you know, those first few years of our life have a profound effect on who we are, or are the blueprints of who we are as adult human beings. And, you know, it's understandably so, given the disentitlement that my parents embodied in their lives, and, you know, kind of some of the misinformation that they were conducting their lives on. I myself was actually hampered early on in life, but, you know, time moves on, and there's a lot more information available, and I was interested in learning and reading, and I've just found my way out of some of the traps that my parents nearly took my parents down. But I say nearly because in the book, over the course of the book, they redeemed themselves in a pretty sweet and loving way. So it, to me, the book is uplifting if you make it to the end.
Oh, it's a great book. And the book is called China Berry Sidewalks, and we're talking with the author, Rodney Crowell. Well, a few weeks ago, I saw Willie Nelson here in town, and he was great. And his own songs were wonderful. But when he really got passionate in the middle of his show when he did a set of Hank Williams songs. Hank Williams, those songs just live on. They seem brand new. And you actually saw Hank Williams, although he died in 1953. So do you actually remember seeing him?
I saw him. My father took me to see him perform 2 weeks before he died. I remember being on my father's shoulders. I remember the smell of his hair tonic. I remember my first ever sense that there was a cool eddy of air that wafted down from overhead that brushed my cheek. I think that eddy of air actually woke me up into this life, and that's sort of when my senses turned on. And I remember the light, and I remember the dull sound, but the memory was reinforced over and over and over again because my father told me, you know, on a weekly basis as I was growing up. Now, you remember I took you to see the Hillbilly Shakespeare. It was an important part of his legacy to me. And so the memory was reinforced by his insistence that I never forget.
So would you say that Hank Williams was the first musical influence you had, or was your father?
I would say my father would be my first. I would say Hank Williams was my first musical influence, and then my father, because as I talk about in the book, my father idolized Hank Williams. So therefore, he would be the first, and then would be my father. But then again, my father also idolized Roy Acuff, and my mother had an absolute schoolgirl crush on Roy Acuff. So it would be Roy Acuff and Hank Williams.
And do you still listen to those guys? Do you ever say, oh, I got to put on my... I haven't listened to Roy Acuff in a while. I better put it on.
I listen to Hank Williams a lot, especially when I'm driving my car. I love Hank Williams. You know, to me, Hank Williams and Lightnin' Hopkins are about, you know, it's like, well, you know, they say if you could die and come back as another musician, I would be hard-pressed to pick between those two. I think I'd probably land on Lightnin' Hopkins.
Really?
Yeah, so because I love Lightnin' Hopkins. I think he's the greatest performer of any generation. I think he even tops Ray Charles and Aretha Franklin.
Mention a handful of Lightnin' Hopkins songs that you think everybody should go listen to right now.
Come Back Baby, Katie May, I Don't Want No Woman Ain't Got No Hair Longer Than Mine, Lightnin's Blues, Lightnin's Boogie, you know, Woke Up This Morning, I Feel So Bad. Oh, that's a good one. I Feel So Bad. I could break right down and cry. Lightnin' Hopkins, he's from East Texas, and just a brilliant guitar player and blues singer. You know, he was obviously influenced by maybe Skip James or some of the early Delta blues guys, but he took it to another place. He's like East Texas country blues, and it is just some of the most breathtaking performances imaginable for me. For me, I put Lightnin' Hopkins ahead of everybody. Dylan, Lennon,
mm-hmm.
Ray Charles.
Well, the first time I ever heard "Ain't Living Long Like This," I thought, "Oh, Elvis should have recorded this."
I wish Elvis had of. You know, but Waylon did a pretty good job of it.
Oh yeah, that's a great record.
Yeah.
Well, was Elvis an influence too?
Elvis was. Although not near the way Hank Williams was, or the way Buck Owens or Merle Haggard were, and then are not as much as the Liverpool lads or Dylan were, because I'm just the age that I was just coming of age of, you know, adolescent age when the Beatles hit, and Dylan followed quickly thereafter.
Yeah,
that really, you know. That really caught me in the same way that Hank Williams caught me when I was, you know, 4 or 5 years old. From there, my musical tastes have, you know, I've followed everything that really moves me.
Well, you mentioned Tom Waits in your book, who's really a contemporary of yours, but you...
Oh, I wouldn't call myself Tom Waits contemporary. I think for my money, he outdistances everybody in terms of poetic sensibility. He's just a beautiful writer. You know, I would have to place him pretty close to Lightnin' Hopkins.
When you're writing a song, do you think, oh, I'm writing this song for somebody? You think, oh, this Elvis could do this song, or do you just write for yourself?
Just for myself. I did that a couple of times, and it doesn't work. If when you do that, you're diluting what you're doing. There's only one reason to write a song. And that's to write it. And if you're trying to write it for Elvis or take your pick, then you're projecting something that's not true or not real. You have to be quiet and let the song tell you what it wants to be. And if you're trying to write a song for Elvis Presley, then you're trying to tell it what you want it to be. It doesn't work for me. All the good songs that I've ever written that have been covered, and there have been many.
Mm-hmm.
We're just me listening to the song and letting it tell me what it wants to be.
I've never gone so wrong as for telling lies to you. What you see is what I've been. There is nothing I could hide from you. You see me better than I can. that lies before me now. There are some turns where I will speak, I only hope that you can hold me now, till I can gain control again.
How does it come to you? Do you have to sit down and say, okay, I'm going to write a song now, or is it grab you, or what?
Oh, no, I've said many times, and I got this line from Emmylou Harris a long time ago, that talking about songwriting is like doing card tricks on the radio. It's mystical and it's mysterious, and it's not unlike taking a blank canvas. You know, if you're a painter and you start to put, you know, maybe you don't know what you're painting when you start putting color on a canvas, and that's the way songs are. Sometimes I have no idea what they want to be. I only have a feeling or a notion, and then I just listen. Listen, those songs will talk to you. If you train yourself to listen to them, they'll talk to you and they'll tell you what they want to be. And it's mystical. It's lovely. I can't believe I've spent my whole adult life doing it.
When did you discover that you had the gift for it?
In my early 20s, I wrote a song called Till I Gain Control Again, which Willie probably performed at the...
Yeah, he did.
I wrote that in my early 20s, and that was when I realized that I could do it. And from there, I felt pretty confident.
Uh-huh. The next one was, they started to flow out of you, or what?
Yeah, they did. You mentioned I Ain't Living Long Like This. It came pretty soon after that.
Uh-huh. Well, what about when you were writing your memoir, China Berry Sidewalks?
Different.
Yeah, what's that like?
Well, you just get up and go to work every day. Writing songs, you keep the craft and your sensibilities sharpened so that when that little nudge of inspiration comes to you, you let it talk to you and tell you what it wants to be. And it usually doesn't take long to capture what that is. You know, I've spent a year working on a song before.
Really?
Because it was difficult. But oftentimes I can usually get them from anywhere to 2 or 3 days to a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But writing a book is labor intensive, and it's stamina, and the inspiration comes from being willing to spend 2 months on one paragraph.
Did you have that same thing where you had to listen to it, or did you know where you were going?
I knew where I was going because I knew the arc of the story, but by the same token, I had to listen to it, too. It's interesting that way. I knew the end of the story I was writing in the book because I'd already lived it. It's memory.
Mm-hmm.
But then I had to listen to the subtlety of how the language wanted to form itself, and I had to coax it. And I would, you know, I've read accounts of sculptors, you know, taking the raw materials of, be it marble or whatever they are, that sculpting, that they, you know, they kind of size or wood and say, well, I know it's in there somewhere, and you just start to remove what doesn't belong. And writing a book is not dissimilar to that. It's like more than anything is getting rid of the words that don't belong.
Well, in this book, you focus on a certain aspect of your life, and you kind of build a monument to your parents, so to speak. Is this the beginning of several memoirs?
I hope so.
Mm-hmm. You have more to say?
I hope I create a readership who wants more from me, because I certainly love the work. Now, most people would think I have a loyal following. It's not small, but it's not grand either. And most people say, well, Rodney Crowley's written a book, I guess it's about songwriting and his career. But it isn't. I didn't think that would be at all entertaining. I'm not a superstar. You know, I don't nominate my life as being particularly interesting that way, but I did have the audacity to think that I was enough of an artist that I could figure out how to paint with words in such a way that I could entertain a reader. And that's what I went for. I wanted to entertain a reader with my ability to write more than telling them how great I am.
Well, in the last few years, we've actually seen a couple of books that are kind of like that. I mean, Patti Smith, her book, Just Kids. It's also not a book about the rise of Patti Smith, the rock star, but focused on a certain aspect of her life. And I guess Bob Dylan's book, Chronicles, you know, he kind of leaves out the entire 1960s in his book.
Yeah, I thought that. I read his book, and I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah.
It's like, I understood, it's like, why would he? How would he try to explain writing like Mr. Tambourine Man? Impossible to explain. That was a gift from the cosmos. However, he did try to. He very eloquently explained how he felt when he was uninspired and when he was feeling really low and unsure about himself. I thought it was a wonderful choice. I would much rather hear him. Read him writing about the vulnerability of being an icon, rather than the exaltation of being an icon.
Well, it's interesting that you say here, because in your book is available for everybody to read, and it's a great read. But it's also available for us to hear you read it. Was that a different experience, reading it out loud?
It was work.
Yeah.
It was work. It did not come instantly, naturally to me, but I'm glad I did it because it helped me. Because the tour I'm doing, I'm reading from my book, and assuming that it's entertaining to my audience, I'm combining stories, song, and readings from the book, and certainly reading it for the audio book helped me get a feel for how to read aloud.
Well, Rodney Crowell, the book Chinaberry Sidewalks, when you read it, your audio version, it's a lot funnier than it is on the page, I think.
Well, that's probably because I know how to accentuate the language in a way that where the humor is palpable.
Yeah. It's a funny book.
I know so. I always thought I was writing a funny book, even when I was writing about how crazy my folks were. I thought they were funny.
Well, you say so. When you cracked up in church and it was your mom that made you laugh.
Yeah. Yeah, she did. Unbelievable.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the role of religion in your life. You write about it in the book.
Yeah.
You want to say anything about it?
Well, religion is... I live a spiritual life, and I have a I think I have a relationship with what a God of my understanding. I wouldn't presume that my understanding of what God is necessarily resonates with everybody, and I certainly think some people, you know, if you're Muslim or Christian or Buddhist, whatever it is, I mean, I'm glad for you. I have a problem with religion when it becomes dogmatic and like, this is the only way. If you don't see it this way, then you're going to hell. You're going to roast forever. I just don't believe that. And I don't think any of us have the market cornered on what it really is. Faith is a belief in something greater than ourselves, and I think when we think that we have defined it in such a way that we can feed it to anybody else, I think that's ego. So I have a problem with religion, basically, but I have no problem with God as anybody might describe them or frame them for themselves.
So it's organized religion, so to speak, that you have your qualms.
Well, I don't really know. I think Catholicism is a beautiful thing. The ritual is beautiful, and you know, certainly the Jewish faith, the ritual, the bar mitzvah, it's really beautiful. The language and the intelligence of the Jewish faith is, I think it's a lovely thing. It's just when human beings think that they have the intellectual and the spiritual and the emotional know-it-all cornered. It's just, it can't be. It can't be. Nobody can have that. Nobody's that intelligent.
Well, I want to ask you about your records. Recently, and well, of course, I still call them records, but they're CDs now. But
there are records.
your most recent records have been released on smaller labels. Is that a different experience to create for a small label than for the major labels that you used to record for?
I haven't changed what I do at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every record I make, I assume that I'm trying to top Sgt. Pepper's of the Dark Side of the Moon or Highway 61. Otherwise, why bother? Now, that doesn't mean that I achieve what I set out to do, but, you know, to me, records, these records we make, these CDs, these albums, whatever you call it, I look at them the same way I would look at a art exhibition. If you know, you do 12 paintings and you exhibit them in a gallery, you want to get your best 12 paintings out there and you want to, you know, put your best foot forward. And that's what I do when I make a record. And I love the process. Whether it's major labels or small labels, it's the same to me. It hasn't changed at all. Now, back in the late 80s and through the early 90s, you know, I was on the radio and selling a lot of records and getting around, and people knew who I was more so than they do now. But, you know, China Berry Sidewalks is going to change that.
Absolutely.
Everybody will know who I am.
Well, Mel, you're being facetious, but are you happy with your level of fame? Do you wish you were more famous, or is it perfect the way it is?
No, I don't want to be more famous. I have no desire to be famous. You know, now wealthy? Absolutely. a lot of things you can do with wealth, you know, for other people as well as yourself. Fame, I don't see it. You know, I've been around too many famous people. I have famous friends, and I've seen it. It's not that much to aspire to from where I sit. And probably with me, if I'd achieved some level of fame, it would have derailed the work that I'm doing now. And from where I sit, if you say, look, I could have been famous 15 years ago and made a lot of money, or you can just continue to work and with a certain amount of humility and create a book like China Berry Sidewalks, I would have taken the book. Honestly.
Yeah?
Yes.
Well, you've mentioned the visual arts a lot. Have you worked in the visual arts? Do you see yourself doing that too?
No, but I have friendships. I have close conversations with poets and painters, and I share my experience with other artists. And I've cultivated relationships with artists who are painters, who are actors, who are writers. And the ongoing conversation about how we do our work is really important to me, and it's part of the it's a part of sustaining inspiration.
Well, Rodney Crowell, the book China Berry Sidewalks is an absolute work of art, and congratulations on it.
Thank you. You're so kind to say that.
And I hope that you'll come back when the next volume comes out and talk to us some more.
I will do that. Thank you for calling me, and thank you for having me on your show.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook or iTunes. I want to thank the brilliant Rodney Crowell for being my guest. Thank you so much. His new book is called China Berry Sidewalks. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, the lovely Ms. Breanne Beal, for all she does. Thanks, Breanne. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.